Welcome to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete Sunshine 96.7 FM. Join us as we celebrate the sparks that ignite, the events that inspire, and the songwriters that create. With your host, Steve Robb.
I'm honored to have with us today one of my personal musical influences, all the way back to my days in college, oh so long ago. Rex Fowler of Aztec Two-Step, welcome to Song Creating.
Well, pleasure to be here with my wife, Dodie, as well, who's now a member of the Aztec Two-Step 2.0 band.
Fantastic, 2.0. I love it, and I've been following the band for so many years, and it's great to see that you guys are just still at it and still touring. And tell us a little bit about Dodie's how Dodie emerged and joined the band here.
We'll try to do it real quick. Neil had decided to retire several years back.
Now this is Neil Shulman, who Rex started the band with.
And they've been together, say, 47 years, I believe, right, Rex?
Almost, yeah.
Yeah.
Really, which is quite amazing. Their fan base really followed them very devotedly for all those years. And they were wonderful. I had seen them a few times over the years, but we had met way back, Rex and I and Neil had met way back in 1979 when they were recording their fifth album called The Times of Our Lives. And that was at Blank Tape Studio in New York City. So I was working there at the time. And that's when I met Rex and Neil. And I actually had the amazing luck of singing and playing guitar on that record on several songs. And so years went by and we ran into each other again about 4 years ago. And we started up a new relationship, Rex and I.
Yeah, we got a little beyond music, I understand.
Yes. But Neil was retiring, and I got to play with Rex and Neil over the last few years about three or four times, which was really terrific. And then Neil kind of bowed out a little bit, so I took over his...
A lot.
His chair.
He bowed out completely.
Yeah.
First, I started playing piano behind Rex and Neil for a few shows, and then I started playing guitar. So here we are.
Do you consider yourself a lead guitar player and filling in Neil's shoes that way?
Well, I over the years, I had played in a lot of bands. I've played guitar since I was in high school and played in rock bands. I had an all-girl band way back in the 60s, and then I segued to guy bands because there weren't too many girls playing. But I always played the lead electric, and I also played acoustic too, which I love. But I play both in this band when as needed, right, Rex?
Yeah. Definitely.
I play both lead and acoustic because they're sort of half and half songs, whatever it's needed.
Yeah. So I haven't heard Aztec Two-Step 2.0, but by the personnel, it's a very different sound. It's not just you and Neil and that terrific bass player that traveled with you so much.
And that's on purpose because, you know, if I were to, if I had gone out and recruited another excellent guitar player, it really would have been unfair to them and our fans because, you know, nobody's going to replace Neil per se. I mean, our vocal blend is something that often gets overlooked. But Neil's, extraordinary guitar playing. So I purposely didn't do that. When I first started out, before Dodie got involved, I brought in, when Neil retired, I brought in another keyboard player because I didn't want somebody standing next to me. And then when Dodie came in, she brought in the multi-instrumental ability, and our vocal blend is something that we continue to fine tune because it's something that, you know, Dodie's from a Broadway career. After her rock and roll career, she spent 15 years on Broadway, and including the 4-year stint with Cats, and then brought in as an original cast member of the Phantom of the Opera. And she, I got that right.
Yes.
And she was brought in as a ballerina. And that's another crazy thing. when I met Dodie in 1979, I had always loved ballet, and I had never met a real ballerina. She was a principal dancer for a company out of Princeton, New Jersey. So she's a multifaceted, multi-talented, uniquely talented beautiful woman, and I'm delighted that we were that we hooked up, and we've been married since August of 2018. So it's been quite a journey.
I'll bet. Let's talk a little bit about your influences and going back. Tell me about how you got going. What inspired you?
Yeah, well, I was going into my senior year in high school, 1966. And I was well on my way to following my grandfather's footsteps as a coach and a teacher. I had never had any interest whatsoever of playing an instrument or singing or anything. I was a jock in all through high school. I lettered in golf my freshman year. That was a big deal. And I went to a prep school. I was a townie in a prep school in Pittsfield, Maine, called Maine Central Institute. So I was on that way. And that summer I had gone down to Booth Bay Harbor, to get out of Pittsfield. And one of the college kids, a kid from Bucknell University, had a bunch of Bob Dylan albums, early acoustic versions. Now, I loved the Beatles. I loved the Rolling Stones. I loved Led Zeppelin. I loved pop music. I loved all kinds of music. But none of them ever inspired me to want to pick up a guitar. But when I heard Bob Dylan's plaintive voice and instrument, it really touched me. It was like somebody took pulled the switch on the train track, and I went from this track over to the other one. And ironically, when I got home that summer, all excited about this guy, Bob Dylan, my sister's college roommate had left an acoustic guitar behind our living room love seat because it was too big to fit in their dorm room, college dorm room. So there it was. It was almost like it was meant to be. And I started pounding away on the E minor chord and Hollis Brown and whatnot, and that really morphed that's how I transitioned into wanting to become a songwriter. I immediately wanted to become a songwriter. I had never written a song or even thought about it, but Bob Dylan absolutely inspired me to want to do that.
Wow, that is quite the transformation. Were you like in high school, were you good at writing English compositions or poetry or anything like that?
That's a good question. My freshman high school teacher, Mrs. Witham, Ann Witham, took me aside after class one time and said to me after, I turned in a few term papers, that she encouraged me to continue to write, especially introspectively. And that had a profound effect on me. Mm. Not that believe me, I'm 4 years away from thinking about writing a song, but it gave me a confidence and it planted the seed that this might be something I might have have a gift at. And when you're a freshman in high school, especially a prep school where there's so much emphasis on academia, and believe me, I was not an academician, it really mattered. And then again, my freshman year in college, my English teacher complimented me on that. And by that time, I already had 15 or 20 horribly written songs in my back pocket. My earliest songs. And again, that really gave me some confidence that I might be onto something here.
Wow. So now where were you in college at this time?
Aroostook State, it's called the University of Maine, Presque Isle, but it was Aroostook State College in Presque Isle, Maine, way up, okay. up on the dew line, as they say.
Okay, so I think I read that you eventually dropped out.
Yeah, when I was determined to make it as a folk singer, and I got deferred from the draft, the one wife status, which meant they take me just before the women and children. I going into my second semester, my junior year, I wanted to go to Boston. That was the folk singing mecca at the time. And thanks to Tom Rush and the Club Passim in Boston and Cambridge. And I went down there and flunked out immediately as a folk singer. That was when I met Jonathan Edwards, who was head and shoulders above everybody that was showing up at the open mics and stuff. And so I stayed there over the winter, and then I went back to Maine, and I knew I had a lot of woodshedding and to do as not just a songwriter, but as a guitar player as well. I was full of youthful exuberance, but I really wasn't ready at that point, to make an impact. And another year or so before I learned how to finger pick and started writing better songs.
So how was your family at this time? Parents supportive?
Well, yes, my folks had divorced. That was the reason why I left Pittsfield. It's a small little town in central Maine, to get away from the town gossip and whatnot. My mother suggested that I try to do that. And so I didn't have the family infrastructure that might have otherwise made me think twice about staying in school and finishing up a degree as a teacher. They did not dissuade me ever. And even though I got no financial support at any time in my life, especially during this time when, I was just going on peanut butter and spaghetti and Thomas's English muffins. And, I worked part-time a little bit, actually full-time the first time I was in Boston. But, they didn't. And of course, they were quite proud when things started happening.
So you flunk out of the folk scene in Boston, as you say. What were the, I assume you played a couple open mics? Or what was your experience there?
Exactly right. I found out where they were and get there and signed up. And that's, as I said, I bumped into Jonathan Edwards early on, and he was something else, man. He was playing in a group called the Headstone Circus and moonlighting as a folk singer, as he told me. And, John and I have stayed in touch over the years. We've done, probably 25 or 50 shows together, even quite recently, after I left Boston in 1969, that winter or spring, I guess, maybe 1970, spring of 70, he had gone on and gotten signed by a record company and had his single, Sunshine, rocketing up the charts. So right after that, I met Neil at an open mic the second time I moved to Boston in 1971. And I went down, we were moved to New York City, where Neil is from, and that's where the music industry was. So we got out of Boston and moved there. And John happened to be playing at Gertie's Folk City, which is a venue that Bob Dylan had played in. And
sure.
Anybody else who ever played, folk music back in the day. And I went down into the dressing room and reintroduced myself to John. And it was, I was surprised he remembered me, but we've been fast friends ever since.
That's great. how was the rejection when you were playing the open mics at the first time you were in Boston? Was it just that did you just sort of hear the crowd noise rising as you're trying to play, or what made it feel, what gave you the impression that it wasn't working out?
Jonathan Edwards.
He didn't mince words, I guess.
Play the guitar, and his songwriting was, you know, light years ahead too. I mean, you know, there's especially a song called Emma, which was on his first album, that really intrigued me. As a funny little sidebar, John showed me the chords to it, and I wrote the lyrics down, and you know, before his record came out, and when we were, you know, folk singing back, I mean, auditioning for gigs back then. And I remember going, my mother moved to Brockton, Massachusetts, remarried and moved to Brockton at that time. And I remember going over there on a college break, and or not, actually this is post-college, but played Emma for her. And she asked me, and I she said, did you write that song? And I went, yeah. And paused, and she goes, no, you didn't. And I got to tell that story to Jonathan Edwards at his 50th anniversary, you know, anniversary in music in Hartford, Connecticut, a couple years back. So that was fun to tell that story. But no, there might be 10 people if you're lucky in an open mic audience, and most of them are musicians. And even when there was a smattering of people who, like, you know, wanted to show up and hear people's songs, it would be like, I described it in my book, it's like golf applause. You know, when
right,
and somebody tips and knocks in a six inch, you know, putt for bogey or something, or par, and you hear this, very much. So it wasn't anything that resembled like some real enthusiastic responses. What I did get, however, though, was a lot of compliments on my voice and even on some songs. So that gave me some confidence and buoyed me. But when I compared myself to John Edwards, I wasn't ready for prime time, and I knew it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you moved back to Maine. And did you continue to perform while you were still, while you were there?
Well, not really. I never performed. And that was part of the problem. I was very self-conscious as a performer. I played for, you know, in my college dorm room, occasionally in, you know, when I got more bold, I would play maybe in the cafeteria rec room or whatever it is, you know, right off the cafeteria or something. But I was always very shy and self-conscious about performing, and it would continue that way until I met Neil. And he was a, you know, this cocksure city kid from New York. And, you know, he really was really good at, you know, being comfortable on stage and whatnot. And I think my songs certainly gave him a lot of confidence in how we sounded together. We knew we had something pretty unique, and when we did our very first gig, I had some gigs lined up already. And one of them was at the Nameless Coffee House, which is still in business, or whatever you call it. They still have their series. It's in Cambridge, Massachusetts, right around the corner from the Passim, as a matter of fact. And there is always a built-in audience. I think it was a Sunday afternoon concert series they had. And they would have four or five people that auditioned and passed the audition to play at this thing. And this was a big deal for me. I got it. And when I met Neil, at one of those little open mics in Boston, I knew immediately that I was interested in him. I heard him warming up before we actually, had our time to play our two or three songs. And as fate would have it, we were the last two guys to go on that evening. And when Neil went on before me, and when he was finished playing, I complimented him, and I was hoping he'd hang around to hear my set, you know, and he did, which was a nice thing to do. And so I afterwards, I approached him and said, listen, I've got some gigs lined up. I really liked your playing. I was, you know, if you'd be interested in rehearsing, maybe we could team up and do these, you know, a few shows that I got lined up. And he was very enthusiastic about it. So we rehearsed three times. We got up on stage for the first time together at the Nameless Coffee House, and probably in front of of at least 100 to 200 kids, college kids. And when I say we blew the room away, we literally blew the room away.
Wow.
It was stunning. I was in shock. I don't know if Neil was or not, but I had never had felt that kind of response to my songs. And they were my songs that he played guitar and sang beautiful harmonies to. But I performed, you know, I know we performed On the Road and Prisoner and Almost Apocalypse and things like that. And we really blew the room away. There was no wow. question. That was like, okay, this is something else.
There's not many things that are better than that.
No, I mean, the enthusiasm is what, I mean, I did get positive response as a solo artist, but not to totally underplay that, because I did. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had the confidence to drop out of school and, you know, move to Boston. I mean, that was a huge thing for a kid growing up in rural Maine who, you know, whatever. So
yeah,
it was the enthusiasm, that the enthusiastic response that blew my mind, and I'm sure Neil's as well. You know, we knew right then and there we had something that was neither one of us could have accomplished on our own.
Let's talk about the song Cockroach Cacophony. I was suffering through another long winter in Rochester in college, and to say winter is long means that you're bordering with two seasons of rain, and then there's summer. And I wasn't there for the summer. And you've got this repeating chord pattern throughout. And what it makes me feel like is plodding through the snow, you know, just plodding through life. And it's you know, one step in front of the other, 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 and having to just keep going. And that's really kind of where you were at this time in your life.
I wanted to depict people who are trapped in the kind of employment that was soul sucking, and I was experiencing it firsthand by working at the Heartland Tannery, making paste for the hides that had been stripped of their hair by, you know, these pools of acid. And, you know, I would have to walk by these people who had these, you know, gas masks on to get into the bowels of the tannery, where they were dyeing and drying these hides. And my job was to make the paste that kept the hides on the conveyor belts, that, you know, the drying belts. So I would get there before it was completely, you know, just as dawn was starting to break, and it was in the dead of winter. So as you know, from Rochester, it gets dark very early. So, and I would be let out of work as, you know, when the sun was already halfway down. So it was a very depressing place to work, but you know, you didn't really see the light of day until the weekend. So I knew that this was not going to be my life's calling. You know, I wasn't going to stay in that kind of menial work. I knew that I could eventually go back to college if I need be and become a teacher. I had great role models, you know, my parents and my grandfather, who actually graduated from Springfield College, and Coach Nesmith, who invented the game of basketball, was his basketball coach. That shows you how old I am. So I had a great role model I knew I wasn't going to stay stuck. But most of the people, because of the poverty that they grew up in and the cycle of poverty that they, you know, they were in with very little or no education, you know, this is something they had to do. So I wanted to try to capture that feeling in this song. And it was probably my most important song, because it was the first time I had written something that I felt was very original, that was me, or I wanted to go introspective. I knew that's where my calling would be. And so it was from, and you mentioned the plotting that you felt, you know, the music was purposely drone-like. It was just four notes, you know, repeated over and over again. And I sculpted a chorus out of that as well. So, and part of that had to do with my, you know, I'm not a gifted guitar player. I never studied theory once I started playing. I still don't know a music note from a billy goat. I wouldn't know what one note did or said or whatever. I do everything by ear, which is not that uncommon for singer-songwriters. some of the most brilliant, you know, are like me. You know, they don't know anything but just going by the skin of their teeth. So anyway, that's a long, short story on Cockroach. I mean, I go into real detail in the book about, you know, showing up at work and doing, you know, it was a surreal environment. You know, in the bowels of this thing where no windows were. And I, like I said, the you know, it was practically dark when I went to work and practically dark when I got out. So it really added to the gravitas of what I was feeling. And in the bowels of, you know, of the Heartland Tannery, my job was to make paste, as I mentioned. And I had a small room, 12 by 12 room with a dangling overhead light. And a mixer that I put the flour and water into, and a little, you know, teeny engine, a motor that stirred it, and it would splatter on the walls. So when I got to work in complete darkness down there, now I had to go in, pull on the light switch, and there on the wall were hundreds and hundreds of cockroaches. And that's how I started my day, every day when I went to work. It led to the two other songs that are on that album. And the second one that followed was On the Road, which was based on Jack Kerouac's novel, which is completely, as you mentioned, that's one of the songs on that album that is nothing like a introspective ballad that we had several on for the Elektra record. That helped balance that album. And that was a gift by a book thrown in my lap by our local pharmacist, who was sort of a hippy-dippy character himself. And he threw it in my lap and said, "Read this, kid, you might like it." And I did. And I wrote what turned out to be the first song ever written for or about Jack Kerouac's work. There was another band, according to his biography on Kerouac, or a biography on Kerouac. There was another band that came out after our song called The Grateful Dead. I never heard of them, but they apparently had a song about called Cassidy that was, you know, that followed. And then, of course, Tom Waits and everybody else after that, you know, got into, you know, were writing songs about it. But apparently I wrote the first one. And that's amazing because it was 15 years after the book was published. On the Road was published in 1957 at the height of Elvis's fame. And yeah. Talk about juxtapositioned styles, you know, Elvis Presley versus, you know, the Beats and Kerouac. So that's a long-winded explanation of that song.
That's okay. So was Cacophony written in between your times in Boston?
No. I wrote it in Maine before I went back to Boston.
So after your first trip there?
Yes.
I
came back and had to have a job, you know, for food on my plate and whatnot.
Yeah.
I worked at the Heartland Tannery, and that song was was one of the three that, you know, including Baconwood, which would be four, that you know, gave me the confidence to head back to Boston, and where I eventually hooked up with Neil.
Now, did you ever play or perform Cockroach Cacophony solo?
Well, I did for a few friends. I didn't play out back then. even after I went to Boston. I mean, I played, I ended up in Portland where my mother had moved with my two younger sisters. And so I did play a few local, you know, clubs or whatever, maybe two or three the whole time I was there. I really was not comfortable performing.
Yeah. I'm just wondering how it was received because, you know, it could be considered repetitive in a way, musically, lyric. So it's really a lyrical song. I mean, that's where the strength of the song is in a solo performance. As you've recorded this, you've got Neil adding some harmonies and, you know, there's, I mean, your production on this then gives it a so much more life. To start this song off, as you created the song and performed it solo, did anybody kind of say, "Hey, Rex, maybe you need a bridge in here or something"? Did that ever come up?
No, that didn't. But you know, the music served its purpose. You know, it, as you mentioned, it's lyric driven, it's story driven, and it's I think it even just me performing it by myself, it's compelling enough a storyline, and I could sing it, and that's one thing I wrote about is that, you know, it was one of the first songs that I felt confident in performing and playing by myself, even the stripped down version.
You have to sing this with emotion. There's a lot, you know, it's just all coming out. And that I think for anybody who's just been kind of stuck in that kind of environment, because thankfully your lyrics aren't specific to what you were doing. They are getting up in the dark, you know, moving about your, you know, trying to make breakfast, you know, go out, come home. It's broad enough in a way that people can relate to it in whatever kind of monotonous, mundane routine they may be in.
That's right. And I wrote it purposely in third person. I didn't say I woke up, you know, clanked a spoon inside a cup and had a cigarette. And then I went to the Heartland Tannery and I worked this horrible job. I wanted it to be something that people would relate to in whatever, wherever they may have been stuck emotionally, you know, or otherwise. And in that sense, I'm sure you would agree, it succeeded.
Was there any song that you styled this after that you can think of from your influences?
As I said, it was the first song I felt had a sense of originality. Now,
yeah,
I'm the first person to ever do, you know, it's that kind of droney kind of thing. I guarantee you not. But there was nobody that I consciously was emulating, which I did very much so and continue to still do, you know, from the masters, starting with Bob Dylan and then Donovan and then John Lennon, of course. Regarding Cockroach and all that stuff, I'm a much better guitar player now, but then I was a very rudimentary player. And those four notes gave me, you know, I write from melody. I never write lyrics first, like Dylan apparently writes everything from lyric. I write, like a lot of people in my genre, I write from music. I get a melody. I get something that I can sculpture a melody, whether it be a verse or chorus or both. One will lead to the other. And then the bridge, of course, because it's a bridge, is always the last thing that happens. But, you know, I write, I use that as the music inspires me, you know, with the mood of the music, this, that, and the other, to write something more introspective or more, you know, whatever, upbeat or whatever you may write about. But I have no idea what, you know, where I'm going with a song or where it's going to end until it's done. I mean, I'll give you a real quick example. The song on our second album, the first RCA record, Second Step, is a song about the Ballad of Humpty Dumpty and Cinderella. And sure. I'm sitting in my room, and I come up with this riff. Da, da, da. Da 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 da, and I go, hey hey hey, did you lose your shoe? And I don't know where the hell that came from, but that's the magic of songwriting. Stuff just appears, and I thought to myself, well, who lost their shoe? Oh, Cinderella lost her shoe. Okay, she said her name was Cinderella, and then you know, and even the last verse where Humpty jumps instead of falls, I had no idea he was going to jump instead of fall. Until the last two lines of the song. So it's, you know.
Well, I remember that when somebody first played that for me back in 1978, I think. And the listener doesn't know that either. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, you know, this all of a sudden it's just Humpty's life takes on all new meaning. And it's that's a great song. I just remember we're playing it and we all kind of looked at each other and went, whoa, that's great.
Yeah, well, it's a whimsical song. It was intended to be, and it was you know, it's been one of those songs that helped define our career.
Yeah. Rex, so 50 years plus in this business, do you have one favorite song that you just have to play every show?
You know.
Or maybe just one favorite song.
You've heard this said, I'm sure, by countless songwriters. They're like children. And even though you might have a favorite, you don't want to necessarily.
Okay.
It, like, hurt your other kid's feelings. I only have one kid, so I don't have to worry about that. But it could be on any given day that I might go, this is the best song I ever wrote. And it's funny because I keep finding myself saying that in my book. This is one of my best songs ever, you know, if not the best song. But I guess if I really, and I probably mentioned this, if I really had to choose one, it would be In Your Paintings, which probably 90%, 98% of the people listening to this, if they know our music, probably don't even remember it. Hmm. On, I think it was on the Living in America album that came out, that we won the Best New York Music Award for Best Folk Album of the Year. And, and I wrote it for my girlfriend, who was not a painter, but I knew it was for her. And it has very flowery, but not over the top imagery of paint, you know, of an allegory of painting and love and loss and stuff like that. It's pretty, by my standards, a pretty complex and beautiful, if I do say so. I mean, I pride myself on melody, and as well as, you know, lyric, and the melody is, it's a really a lovely melody too. So I guess if I had to say one song, that would be In Your Paintings.
I'll definitely check that out. I'm sure we can probably find that like everything else on YouTube or Spotify somewhere.
You might be able to find a record version of it. I'm not sure if Neil and I, we did perform it, but not as much as, you know, the first two albums.
Yeah. So you and Dodie are now co-writing. How does that dynamic work for you?
Well, it's been really something. I mean, she has really made such a difference in my life. I mean, what the dynamic is usually, I'll start a song and she'll come in and help me finish it up. And I think the best example of that, and I know it's on YouTube, it's a song called Words, and it's the subtitle is How Do You Tell Someone? And I started to write it when Neil's wife, Karen, passed away at the end of 2017. That was the tipping point for him for getting off the road, you know. I started this song, and I had a nice melody and, you know, and verses and choruses structured. But it's a very complex topic, and it's an the theme of the song is impossible to put into words. The feelings that you want to convey to somebody who lost someone dear to them. And Dodi had experienced this in her lifetime. Previous to me meeting her, her late husband, Kevin Gray, who she met cast of, he came in as Raoul and then transitioned into the Phantom in the Phantom of the Opera, and she had met him there, and they fell in love and had a 25-year marriage until at a very young age he just collapsed and died from a heart issue, unexpected and startling. And so she took her experience and really hammered home the fact that it's almost better to say nothing than to try to pontificate on whatever somebody may be feeling when they have this kind of loss. And so that really, it's the most adult, quote unquote, song that I've ever been involved with. And she helped me tremendously flesh that the lyrics out and contributed a great deal to that. The other thing she did was write this amazing musical bridge that gets us away from the constant messaging of the song. And it was in a completely different key, and it's beautifully written and performed. She's an extraordinary musician. And, the fact that she's following in Neil Schulman's footsteps, which is no easy task, for our fan base, because he was so revered and respected as a musician. So to really overcome the prejudice and skepticism that a lot of people have and continue to have, because people stay away in droves. They won't even come out and see us perform because Neil's not in the band. So, but she is an extraordinary musician. She brings a dynamic to the music that Neil and I never had, because Neil didn't play electric guitar, and she she's a killer electric guitar player. And if you don't believe me, go get on YouTube and watch Prisoner, because she completely transformed that song into something else.
Super. I got a lot to catch up on with you guys. I'm still living in the past with Aztec Two-Step, but 2.0, and you guys are killing it.
I hope other people, maybe folks that listen to this who were fans and who may have not, either for whatever reason, people go on and have their own lives and get away, most of us don't stay as passionate about music as we, as our high school and college years, as we get older and into our own lives. But the folks that do would, I think, be quite pleasantly surprised. I purposely have tried not to represent the music like I did with Neil. I love playing with the five-piece band. It's just completely energize me. And if we continue to write some pretty good songs, and if you want to fool around on YouTube, you could probably hear some of them. Apocalypse Now is another one that I'm very proud of. We tend to try to write about environmental issues as well. There's so much going on in that area. Sure. And of course, I've always been a gun control advocate, and I get that into songs. The title track of Naked, the title song of our album Naked, references that very quickly. I try not to beat people over the head with it, but I try to write consciously try to write things that I think are important to our
as true folk singers do.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. All right. Rex Fowler, so glad to have you on Song Creating. Dodie Pettit, it's great to have you. And it sounds like the music that you two are making together now is just taken on a whole new life. And obviously, Rex talks and acts like a 30 something. So I think you brought new life to the old man.
Oh, that's great. He did to me as well, because as you know, I was a widow before I met him. I re-met him.
Right. Well, I think it's wonderful. And thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having us and continued success. It's a great concept. It's a great premise. And we're all grateful that songwriters like myself, I'm sure, we're all grateful to have the opportunity. So much.
Thank you. We're going to close with hearing the original version, original recorded version of Cockroach Cacophony. Thanks very much, guys.
Adios.
A buzz of sounds to wake you up and steals a dream that you thought was real. You close your eyes again, feel your face with your hand. Again you dream, but not the same. A different name, another game. You'd like to stay, you know you can. You leave your bed to wet your face. First water hot, then water cold. You see yourself as half awake. You know you're young, you feel so old. And as the guard turns slow to gray, it's neither night, it's neither day. You like to stay, you know you can. You look away. What's confronting you is all that you can think about, is what's confronting you. You turn the light to find some clothes, you put them on, go to the stove, replace the water on the flame. The faucet drips into the drain. You crank a spoon inside a cup, a cigarette, you know you're up. You ask for what you cannot say. Life, oh bleeding life, who labors on with every breath, and takes you reeling, blindly wheeling, ever closer to your death. You hear the judge and jury curse, you watch them sentence you to thirst. And as you move from womb to breast, from nothingness to nothing less, you look away. What's confronting you is all that you can think about. It's all that you can think about is what's confronting you.
spend the day, go back to sleep and hide away inside a dream. Through miles and miles and miles and miles of dreary gray, you like to stay.
Listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM. If you like what you hear, you can find Song Creating on your favorite podcast app or at songcreating.com. To check out my own music, go to steverobb.com. And until next time, keep a song in your head and music in your heart. Thanks for listening.